This is Being Catholic with Bob Johnston on Catholic Spirit Radio 89.5.
Hi, this is Bob Johnston, and you're listening to Being Catholic right here on Catholic Spirit Radio 89.5 FM in good old McLean County, 92.5 in Bloomington Normal, 88.3 up in Pontiac, and 97.1 down in Lincoln. We're going to have a great show for you today. I'm here with my wife, Lynn. And I hope everyone has had a very happy Thanksgiving, happy Thanksgiving holidays. We're already into Advent. And as you probably know, we missed, I think, the last couple of shows and ran some older shows in those spots because of some technical difficulties and some other difficulties that we've had in getting together for the show. So hopefully everything will go smoothly. And looking forward to having a great Christmas and everybody else having a great Christmas. And we've got sort of an eclectic show for you today. We're going to do a number of different things. I want to remind everybody out there that, of course, we can always use your donations. We're brought to you by you. And if you want to make a donation, the best thing you can do is go to our website, CatholicSpiritRadio.com. Again, that's CatholicSpiritRadio.com. You can call us here at the station at 309-807-2427. If you want to, but the best thing to do is go to CatholicSpiritRadio.com. That's our website. It'll give you a lot of information about us, and you can make a donation that way. And so we're going to go into what we're going to talk about today, and we're going to talk a little bit about Christmas, and in doing so, we'll do some from Dickens, A Christmas Carol, and a little bit of an introduction to Charles Dickens himself. So we'll do a little bit of that from Joseph Pierce's literature, What Every Catholic Should Know, that we had been doing in the past several weeks. And I think that will be very appropriate for the Christmas season to start it off. And we'll do also some interesting other things as well. From First Things, some interesting odds and ends that we have in the magazine First Things. And we're going to talk a little bit to start off with about the Bishop Sheen situation. I know everyone is talking about it. There's been a delay in his beatification, and we're going to try to explain a little bit of that we talked about or we saw on EWTN's Raymond Arroyo show, The World Over Live. So we'll get into that a little bit. And before we start, I'm here with my wife, Lynn. I want to turn it over to her if she has anything to say. Go ahead, Lynn.
Yes, I would like to say welcome to the people, the listening audience in Lincoln. We had to go down to Springfield to St. John's this week, and on the way we were able to catch the EWTN programming on Spirit Radio. All the way, wasn't it Elkhart?
No, we went we went from Lincoln all the way just about as we were coming into Sherman, right there on the very edge of Springfield, is when it started to break up just a little bit. So
it was clear, really good, and you know we are at full power now in Lincoln as of this last 10 days or so. So welcome to everybody. We're glad to have you part of the family.
Yeah, it was coming in really well, and it was coming in. We started to pick it up. In fact, actually, we were listening to Bloomington Normal, and when we got down around McLean or a little bit south of McLean, it started to be a little of interference, and I said, I wonder if that's Lincoln interfering with us, so let's turn it over to Lincoln. And we did, and we picked up Lincoln right there. So right at the edge of McLean, we picked up Lincoln, and it stayed with us all the way until we got to Sherman.
Okay, well, we're recording on Saturday afternoon, and I just wanted to mention that tomorrow we're going to go up to LaSalle, Illinois. You know, it's straight north of here on 39. It takes about 54 minutes, 55 minutes to get there. We're going to go to the Sung Latin Mass, and I'm really looking forward to that. That's the Mass that we grew up with, and it's the extraordinary form. I mean, to me, it's not extraordinary. It's the way it was, but it's the right.
And of course, this is going to be a high Mass, so
right.
We will.
It'd be a solemn high Mass.
Whereas over in Fairbury, it's usually not. I don't know if they have a high Mass over there or not, but the ones we've been to over at Fairbury were not. So
no, they weren't. They weren't. I'm really looking forward to that. And the week, not this week, of course, but the next week, following that, we will have on Floyd Anderson of the Latin Mass community of Bloomington Normal to talk more about the Latin Mass.
Yeah, that's coming up a week from today, on the 14th is when he's coming on.
Man, time is flying, isn't it? We're going to be at Christmas before you know it. It just seems too fast. Time goes by faster when you get older anyway. So.
Some people say it doesn't. Some people say it does. It does for us, it seems like.
Yeah.
At any rate, well, let's talk a little bit about the Sheen delay.
Yes.
Why this is happening. We watched on Raymond Royal World Over Live on EWTN TV last night, and we recorded it and then watched it again this morning to make sure that we had everything right. And I want to give you a little bit of synopsis of that, and Lynn, you know, you can come in and anytime you want and comment on it. But he came on, and he was talking about, you know, the fact is that the Holy See, the Vatican, delayed the December 21st beatification due to protests placed by U.S. bishops. You know, it's sort of like what the headline, you know, ran on the program. And the upshot is that a bishop in New York, Bishop Salvatore Matano of Rochester, New York, fired off, according to Arroyo, a blazing letter to the Vatican, and who claims he has information. I mean, Arroyo said he has information from highly placed sources that said it was a blazing letter, that this Salvatore Matano sent off a blazing letter to the Vatican wanting to stop the beatification process. And the same bishop, Salvatore Matano, in late June, it was he who delayed the canonization at that time, the proceedings, by suddenly producing documents concerning abusers handled by Sheen. And then, of course, the Peoria Diocese cleric, James Cruz, and a lawyer examined those documents, and the documents actually cleared Sheen. So Sheen has been extremely well investigated and extremely well vetted, and all of these records and documents, you know, has been investigated. I mean, after all, this has been going on for 17 years, I guess. It's been like 17 years that a lot of these this examination has been going on. So Bishop Sheen has been vetted and investigated by the church very completely, and all of the documents have been looked over, and every time there was any kind of a delay whatsoever, you know, it's been proceeded. So at any rate, that's what happened last June. And so his beatification was held up, and then not long ago it was pronounced by the Vatican that, you know, because this James Cruz, the priest, Monsignor James Cruz, and a lawyer examined those documents and found that they actually cleared Sheen, that the proceedings started again, and everything was set up here for the 21st. And now the same Matano has, you know, fired off that letter to the Vatican, stopping the investigation. I mean, you know, stopping the proceedings again. So there's where we're at. Is there anything that I missed that you want to bring in at this point?
Yeah, I wanted to point out that in Rome, they did reinvestigate these charges and cleared it, too, since June. I mean, it's not just in the Peoria Diocese that did the investigation. Rome was involved, and they cleared it,
so it's too.
And then now, because of the change in the law or whatever in New York, the statutes of limitations have been removed, or you can bring complaints, and you know, any time after, it could go back to 1940.
What has happened is the statute of limitations have been suspended for people who want to make an accusation against the Catholic Church. They have a year, and the ordinary statutes of limitations will be suspended if they make the accusation in that year. And evidently, it might be that people are saying, these priests and so forth are saying that, well, there could be an accusation made, you know, in this year, so they're stopping it again. But the point is that even if there was an accusation made, the fact is that the church has done a thorough job of investigating in the first place. So at any rate, the Vatican proceeded then to set the date for the 21st. Then Matano fired off that letter, and it was back by New York Cardinal Tim Dolan and Chicago Cardinal Supich also was in on this and were backing the Matano in this delay. So there's two Cardinals that are backing this, Dolan and also Supich.
Yeah, Dolan's an archbishop. He's not a cardinal.
Isn't
yeah.
he a cardinal?
No.
Okay, he's not a cardinal. Okay, Dolan's an archbishop. Okay, the Archbishop Dolan and then Cardinal Supich. And then, of course, there's the Bishop Matano. At any rate, they cautioned the Vatican to wait for the New York Attorney General report, you know, which will come out. But the point is, as Raymond Arroyo made, is that why should we be waiting for a secular, you know, authority to give permission for a beatification or to canonize a saint when the church has done a thorough job of investigating in the first place? Now, you could say, well, you know, it's a good thing to stop this because accusations can be made. The point is, though, is then that stops all canonizations because accusations can be made anytime. It's one of the fallouts, of course, of having priests and bishops who were involved in this kind of horrible thing of sex abuse of children. So that's one of the fallouts that happens. But the point is that Sheen has nothing to do with all this, as we'll go on to see. At any rate, the church already has done a much more thorough investigation on Sheen alone. Of course, the Attorney General in New York is investigating cases in general, whereas the church and the beatification, the canonization of Sheen, has been investigating just him. So it's a more thorough investigation than the secular authorities ever could do. And if anybody makes a false accusation, they can do that anytime. So that's the point Arroyo was making, is that by doing this, we're putting things into the hands of secular authorities to direct what the church can or can't do. And that is something that we should not let happen, according to Raymond Arroyo, and I happen to agree with that. What about you, Lynn?
Oh, I agree with them, too. You know, it relates to just like the decision that was made for towards China to let the government more or less take the lead in deciding who is going to be bishop.
And then,
you get to that, too. You know, who's making the decisions here?
And then, of course, the other thing is that the New York has a history of opposition here. Of course, they did not want Sheen to be, you know, brought back to the Peoria Diocese and his shrine and canonization, everything be done here, because, of course, there is the, you know, wanting to have that same shrine and that, you know, fame, I guess you might call it, or whatever, publicity and so forth, to remain in New York. And you can understand a little bit of that push and pull. But the point is, as Arroyo made, you know, this is a beautiful time of year. We're just starting Advent. The Christmas season is coming on. And what a grace it would be to have a new saint, you know, from our area right here during this season. It would be a blessing and a grace. And there is no reason, according to Raymond Arroyo, not to do this because the investigation has been so thorough already. So the question becomes then, with this history of opposing Sheen's being here, is this being done out of jealousy because it was Peoria, the diocese, that won this battle, you know, over who is going to have Sheen's remains enshrined? Is it greed? You know, because there would be, I guess, if you have a shrine and so forth, pilgrims and maybe money involved. Is it revenge? And when I say that mode of revenge, it seems that a New York Cardinal Spellman and Sheen were sort of in at odds with each other back in the past, according to Arroyo and his sources. Cardinal Spellman wanted money from Sheen. Of course, had a very popular television show, and he had a lot of missions that he supervised and shepherded, and that Spellman wanted money from the millions that Sheen took in, especially much of those from the federal government, for his missions to help the poor. A lot of powdered milk, and milk was being given out by the federal government, or money was being given to buy milk for the poor people and for some of the poor in the school systems back at that time. I guess this was in the late 1950s and maybe the very early 60s, and so forth. And Sheen refused to do that. he said that, you know, he wasn't going to let anything out of his control that was going to the missions that, you know, he was responsible for. So, in effect, he was taking care of his flock first, and that put him at odds with Cardinal Spellman. So, did that set some kind of an animosity against Sheen out there in New York?
Well, Spellman said he'd get even.
Yes, he did. And, Sheen never mentioned this in his biography. He mentioned that there was sort of a rift, but he didn't mention names and he didn't mention what Spellman did. Yeah, Spellman actually said that Sheen would pay for this someday. So is it something to do with that? I would hope not, but, I mean, those things come up. And then, at any rate...
That's why Sheen was taken off the air, too. Spellman said that's it. He was, you know, he'd get even. Well, he made sure he got off the air, and they isolated him back up into Rochester, New York, to be the bishop there, to get him out of the way. I think they call it like Episcopal Siberia.
Yeah, I guess it would be. So at any rate, all of this comes into play.
Sheen couldn't even have a program or anything in his own diocese.
Yeah, he would not. The other thing that Sheen did that could put him at odds with some of these people is that back at that time, there was this idea that if priests were accused of abuse or proven that they of abuse, that they were retired from ministry, but then they were sent for rehabilitation to psychologists or psychiatrists and so forth, and often reassigned, somewhere else. And Sheen refused to do this. He would not compromise on child abusers. He would not reinstate them for any reason whatsoever. And that caused a rift also, I think, because of the philosophy and the thinking of the time. Back in those days, there was this idea of, more tolerance, and you can rehabilitate anybody, and psychologists and psychiatry could, do these kinds of things. And evidently, Sheen did not go along with this, but for whatever reason, at any rate, he would not reinstate these people. And that might have put him at odds also. And so he refused to endanger children. He protected his missions. In other words, from my opinion, as a traditionalist, and an Orthodox Catholic, Sheen was doing his job as a bishop. He was guarding his flock. And so is this a reason? I mean, I don't know the answers to all these, and, more of this may come out. We'll see. But, New York seems to have an animus against Sheen. Has this got anything to do with it? Or is there something deeper than this that, we don't know about? So I don't know. Anyhow, why did Supich get involved in this? He's from Chicago. So, what's the thing here? And these people sort of seem to hang together. And Arroyo seemed very upset over this whole thing. He said that he spent a whole week, on this story, looking into all the sources. And the things that we've been saying here, that he has all of this vetted from high sources within the church. So there you have it, and you can make of it what you will. Do you want to comment any further on it?
No, I think, it wouldn't hurt for anybody to go online even to look up. Even Wikipedia covers Sheen Spellman.
Be careful online, though, because you can get a lot of misinformation there, so be careful. At any rate, we're going to have to take a break here in this segment of the show, and we're going to go on to some other things, so stay with us. We'll be right back.
You've been listening to Being Catholic with Bob Johnston on Catholic Spirit Radio 89.5.
Join Jason Bramley of Catholic Conversations on a religious journey across Greece, following in the footsteps of the Apostle Paul. This 9-night, 10-day tour begins and ends in Athens, starting with 5 nights on land, followed by a 3-night cruise. The final night is back in Athens to bring this journey to a close. For more information on this spiritual trip, call Ben McKenna, 309-922-1758.
I would like to invite you to prayerfully consider remembering Catholic Radio in your will. By naming Catholic Spirit Radio in your will, you can help continue the evangelization of Jesus Christ and His Church, continuing the legacy of solid Catholic instruction for many years to come. For ideas on how you can help Catholic Spirit Radio, please call us at 309-807-2427 or visit the Giving Options section of our website at catholicspiritradio.com.
This is Bob Johnston. You're listening to Being Catholic right here on Catholic Spirit Radio. We're back from our break. We're talking a little bit about Bishop Sheen and the delay in his beatification and some of the things surrounding that. I hope it was interesting, and if anything new comes up, we'll keep you posted. It's one of Catholic Spirit Radio's jobs to try and keep Catholics up on what's going on in the church, you know, both good and bad, and we certainly hope that this is resolved and that we can have a new saint here in our own diocese, and we get this done shortly. So, again, we'll see what happens. Is there any further that you want to comment on this, Lynn?
Not really, except we need to pray to get this straightened out.
That's a good idea. The church, the Pope, all of us, you know, we all need to pray, and the church, you know, needs our prayers, and you know, and the kind of things that seem to be going on at the time now. I want to relate this to what we're going to talk about right now a little bit. I'm going to talk about Charles Dickens, and we're going to do something from A Christmas Carol, so we'll be a little bit Christmassy. But we're going to talk first, very shortly, about the Victorian age in literature. And there was a lot of things turning upside down during the Victorian age. It was an age in which there was a tremendous loss of faith, which has, you know, poured over into the 20th and the 21st century as well. And so I think that does what they were going through relates a little bit to what's going on in our own age now. And then that will be a good introduction to Charles Dickens and his story, A Christmas Carol, which is appropriate, a story of redemption. And that's, of course, I think what we all need in this day and age is a story of redemption. And it's been with us, you know, for a long time, very popular. But at any rate, G.K. Chesterton devoted the first part of his book, The Victorian Age in Literature, to examining what he termed the Victorian Compromise. He was alluding to the spirit of pragmatism. And I think it was actually during the 19th century that that word maybe was even coined, pragmatism. And pragmatism is really not a very good philosophy. It's always, you know, pragmatism means compromise, and it's a compromise a lot of times between two things, one of which is a lower one. And usually the compromise, when you make compromises like that, it always leads to a weakening of the stronger virtues in favor of the less strong virtues. Not always, but most of the time. And so pragmatism is, you know, not, in my opinion at least, a very good philosophy to follow. But at any rate, it was one of the chief characteristics of 19th century England. And yet the essence of the Victorian conundrum, of which Chesterton was a perspicacious observer, had as much to do with ineradicable contradiction as with pragmatic compromise. The age of Victoria, 1837 to 1901, the Queen, of course, who the Victorian period is named after, the age of Victoria saw the rise of empire and also the rise of anti-imperial nationalism. So here's another thing. It saw the rise of empire, and it also saw the rise of anti-imperial nationalism. Notice here, nationalism is opposed to empire. We have all of this accusations from the left anymore about nationalism somehow or another being a philosophy which, you know, wants to make a nation prime in the superior power of the world and all that kind of thing. Notice that that is not the case at all. It was the nationalists that opposed back at that time empire. And it's nationalists today that oppose empire. They don't mean that a nation should be superior to everybody else. They just mean that a nation should be its own and look to its own characteristics and protect itself and so forth, while at the same time acknowledging the others in the world to do the same thing. But at any rate, it was an attitude, both oppose contradictions again is what I want, the word I'm looking for. It had the triumph of industrialism was taking place during the Victorian age, and also a very great entrenched anti-industrialism rose. It saw the rise of capitalism and the birth of Marxism. So you had all these oppositions, imperialism as opposed to nationalism, industrialism as opposed to anti-industrialism, capitalism as opposed to Marxism, and Darwinian science, you know, materialism was opposed also to the Romanticism, the Dickensian Romanticism of the age. It was an age of emboldened atheism, and yet the age of resurrected religion, people were reacting to the atheism of the time, and there was a resurrection of religion. So it was an age of contradiction. It was the age of disillusioned agnosticism, but also the age of returning faith. So it was all of these things. In fact, in one of Dickens's novels, A Tale of Two Cities, he starts out the very work. The very beginning of the novel starts out, it was the best of times and it was the worst of times. Dickens himself captured that contradictory philosophy or whatever, contradictory current of the times. He captured that with that, it was the best of times and it was the worst of times. So that's a little bit about the Victorian age and the age of Charles Dickens, and we'll talk about Charles Dickens himself. And it could be argued that after Shakespeare, Dickens is the finest writer in the English language. His words have forged their way into the canon to such a degree that it is much more difficult to know which of his novels to leave off the recommended reading list than it is to choose which to include. And notice when Joseph Pearcy refers to the canon, when he's talking about the canon of Western literature, he's talking about the old classical idea of Western literature, not a lot of the ideas of the more modern idea in which all kinds of, in my opinion, garbage and trash is incorporated instead of the lasting works of the time. But anyway, in terms of pure brute statistics, A Tale of Two Cities is his best-selling novel, with the sales exceeding 200 million. But those who are justifiably skeptical of the claim that the best-selling is necessarily the best might point to a poll conducted by the Folio Society, a de facto private members club for bibliophiles, for book lovers, as a more objective way of judging the best of Dickens as opposed to the most popular. More than 10,000 members of the society voted in 1998 for their favorite books from any age. The Lord of the Rings triumphed, Pride and Prejudice was runner-up, and David Copperfield, by Dickens, of course, was third. Why, one wonders, was this particular Dickens classic selected ahead of Nicholas Nickleby, Oliver Twist, Great Expectations, or Bleak House? Well, of those that are named, I would have picked Great Expectations because I read that novel when I was a freshman. I think you did too, didn't you, Lee?
Yes.
When I was a freshman in high school, and I thought it was a great novel. It's a great novel for young kids to read. I think every freshman in high school ought to read Great Expectations. It's a wonderful story. It moves right along. It's really interesting. It's long, but I mean, it's just fine. And the characters in it, of course, Dickens' characters, as you know, I mean, he's got such a repertoire of characters. It's incredible. Scrooge, of course, is probably the epitome of all of his characters. But at any rate, I loved Great Expectations. But it goes on here. Joseph Pierce says, who can possibly know, why various ones are picked as opposed to others? It's hard to know. It is a mystery as insoluble as that surrounding Edwin Drood in Dickens' last unfinished work. In any case, and irrespective of these populist and elitist judgments, none of these Dickensian heavyweights win the vote of the present author, whose favorite work by Dickens is the perennially popular tale of the conversion of Ebenezer Scrooge as told in A Christmas Carol. And I agree. What about you, Lynn?
Oh, yes. Scrooge, that has come into the English language to say, if you say Scrooge, everybody knows what you're talking about.
Exactly. And it's like in the beginning of the novel. I mean, it's not a novel. It's a novella, I guess. It's not quite a short story. It's not quite a novel, a novella. And everybody knows when you think of Scrooge, you could take, as it says in the beginning of the book, you could take a piece of flint and scratch screws with it, and you would knock off a spark from the old skin flint.
Yeah.
And this is exactly the characteristic. Most people don't probably know that when Dickens first wrote that tale, the word Scrooge was to be pronounced Scroog.
Scroog.
Did you know that?
Scroog? No, Scroog.
Yeah. Scroog. S-C-R-O-O-G-E was to be pronounced Scroog. And I guess the idea was it was supposed to sound like a very squeaky, tight-fisted, skinflint. It was sort of like a squeaking door shutting, like a rusty hinge, like that, sort of shutting. And it was supposed to suggest someone who was, a skinflint like Scrooge, very tight, hanging on to every single thing with all the, not letting any of his money go.
Yeah, you can really see that when you use that word and so forth. You can almost, like you say, hear the door squeaking and so forth. And it fits right into the whole novel.
Exactly.
And the visitations and so forth.
It was originally published in 1843, and A Christmas Carol was sandwiched in chronologically between Barnaby Rudge and Martin Chuzzlewit, a couple of his other works. And these were, of course, much weightier tomes. In fact, Scrooge sort of wrote A Christmas Carol on the fly, and he himself didn't think it would amount to a lot. He wrote it for one of the magazines he wrote for. Of course, he wrote most of his stories were serialized. He wrote them for magazines, and they came out as serials. And people just, sat on the edge of their seats waiting for the next one. In fact, the wharves in New England would be crowded when the ships came in from England for all kinds of people waiting for his books to come in, because they had read the, part, let's say, of
Chapter one
or chapter whenever he stopped. And, of course, that's why his novels, for one thing, were so long, because the longer he could stretch them out, the more money he made. So he'd write these long, long stories. But he had the ability to take and write these tomes, these huge novels, and make them good, make them fun to read. And so people waited, back in those days, you didn't have radio, TV, and all that. You had the newspapers, and you had books. And so they waited for these to come in. And he was always angry at America, Charles Dickens, because a lot of times, the people would copy what he wrote and publish it without paying him any royalties, because this was over here in America and they could sort of thumb their nose at England. Of course, it was the wrong thing to do, and America should have been more strict and enforcing the copyright rules and regulations, because they'd get away with it over here. So it left Dickens with an animosity toward America. So when he came to America and visited, he says a lot of nasty things about the country. If you read history, he wrote about his travels in America, and if you read those writings, you'll see in there all kinds of comments about Americans as being, sort of like crude and rude and all of that. A lot of that was because of his animosity on account of they were stealing his material.
Oh, okay. That makes sense. The one thing I always liked about Dickens' novels, and most of them, I think all of them that I've read, his characters come back again, like in life. You go through life and you have a certain period of time, you have certain friends, and then later on, they kind of go away, and then later on in life, they'll pop up again.
They pop up
again. His characters always do.
Yeah, you get just a very tiny description of somebody in the early part of the novel, and then that same person, there's a reason for that, and then that person pops up again. I think Alfred Hitchcock I don't know if he took it from Dickens or not, but I bet he did. In a lot of his stories, in movies and so forth, Alfred Hitchcock, you see something, a clue or something, or a thing or a person, and then it plays a role again later on in the movie.
Yes.
And this is what Dickens did with characters and so forth a lot.
Yes, he did. I find that very enjoyable. You read his stuff and you wait, see who's going to come back into the picture.
Yeah. At any rate, Scrooge wasn't, I shouldn't say Scrooge, but A Christmas Carol was never meant to have the weight of some of his bigger novels. Yet Dickens' ghost story not only punches beyond its weight, but outpunches its heavyweights. So, at least switching metaphors, the character of Ebenezer Scrooge like a genie released or unleashed from a bottle, escapes from the pages of the book to charm the collective psyche of the culture. He's no longer confined to the book. He's everywhere. I mean, as soon as you say the word Scrooge, everybody knows exactly what you mean. You call somebody a Scrooge, and everybody knows what you mean.
Yeah.
He is a literary colossus who, without the benefit of eponymous billing, that is, without the benefit of something named after, you know, somebody, after a person, he didn't have that kind of billing, has emerged from Dickens's imaginary menagerie as a cautionary icon of mean-spirited worldliness. Scrooge is an eponym now. I mean, Scrooge means, you know, meanness, greed, all of those things. Serving as a mirror of scorn and pity towards man, which Tolkien considered one of the chief characteristics of all good fairy stories. And isn't that true with fairy stories? I mean, the fairy stories, there's always an ogre, a monster, and so forth. But somewhere under that monster, there's human qualities.
Yes.
That, you know, if you find
the monster will manifest them in some way.
Yeah. If you find some way to touch the monster, you find out that the monster is a lot of times suffering from some injustice.
Yes.
And when that injustice is righted, the monster is pointed in the right direction, he changes. And isn't that how human beings supposedly, you know, the Catholic Church at least looks at humans that way. They're born, you know, with a tendency, you know, in other words, concupiscence, a tendency toward evil. But basically, you know, a goodness at the core if it can be brought out. So, at any rate, Scrooge has shone across the generations as a beacon of hope and redemption, as powerful parabolically as the prodigal son, of which he is a type. And he is a type of the prodigal son story, and we'll come back and talk about that a little bit. But right now, we're going to take a break, so stay with us. We'll be right back.
You've been listening to Being Catholic with Bob Johnston on Catholic Spirit Radio 89.5.
G.K. Chesterton wrote, "We do not want a church that will move with the world. We want a church that will move the world." Indeed, it was the Holy, Catholic, and Apostolic Church that built Western civilization. Discover the sublime beauty, transcendence, and silence of the ancient liturgy that formed so many of our great saints. To connect with the Latin Mass community of Bloomington Normal, visit latinmassblono.org. That's Latin Mass, BLONO.org.
Did you know that you can donate to Catholic Spirit Radio through your IRA? If you are 70 and a half or older, you can make a charitable transfer of IRA assets, also known as a QCD, a qualified charitable distribution, which is treated as a gift to Catholic Spirit Radio and for which you will receive tax benefits in return. If you make a QCD, you receive a credit against those pesky required minimum distributions, also known as RMDs, that you otherwise have to take from your IRA annually. Your qualified charitable distribution is excluded from taxable income, which may reduce the amount of Social Security benefits which are otherwise subject to income tax. As you plan for 2020 or even 2021, we encourage you to consider making a gift of IRA assets to Catholic Spirit Radio. You'll receive these tax benefits even if you do not itemize. If you're interested in donating to Catholic Spirit Radio through your IRA, please contact your tax advisor.
Hi, this is Bob Johnston. You're listening to Being Catholic right here on Catholic Spirit Radio. We're back from our break, and we're talking about Charles Dickens, and we're talking specifically about his novel, A Christmas Carol, not his novel, novella, A Christmas Carol, and the character of Scrooge. And Joseph Pierce here in his book, Literature, Whatever Catholics Should Know, is commenting on the story. And he's saying that Scrooge is a sort of a type of the prodigal son and the prodigal son's story, you know, in the Bible. And I would have to agree with that, wouldn't you, Lynn, in its own way?
Oh, it is. He's returning. He's coming back, returning to humanity, really, coming back to God.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the prodigal son took off.
He's totally isolated.
Yeah,
he
left his father and his father's estate and his brother and so forth, and he goes out and spends, he wants his inheritance ahead of time. And he gets it, and he goes out, and he blows it all. I mean, Scrooge, of course, it was a skinflint and a miser, and he didn't blow money. But he did the same thing, in effect. You know, he sort of left home and hearth and society.
For different reasons. He did the same thing.
Different reasons, but in fact, he ruined his life and didn't even realize it, and eventually did, and he came back. You know, he was redeemed. He helped redeem himself, and he was redeemed. So the stories are similar, very similar. It is significant as the story begins that Dickens makes a comparison between the ghost of Jacob Marley and the ghost of Hamlet's father. So Dickens is comparing some things here to Shakespeare. In Shakespeare's play, as in Dickens' story, the ghosts serve to introduce not merely a supernatural dimension to the work, but a supernatural perception of reality. In other words, if you go back and look at Hamlet, Hamlet really didn't see what was going on with his mother and going on with the new king, Claudius, until his own father's ghost comes back and informs him of the fact that he's been murdered. I mean, in other words, Hamlet's father, the king, has been murdered, and the new husband of his mother, Claudius, the new king, has usurped the throne and taken over. And Hamlet's not made aware of that. When he suddenly is, of course, Hamlet is faced then with a conundrum that he wishes to a certain extent, and a lot of us do this, that we didn't have to face.
Right.
And I think Scrooge is the same way, isn't he? When in a story, when the ghost first appears, or Marley's ghost first appears and tries to make Scrooge aware of what's really going on with him and his business, Scrooge resists it.
Right. He didn't want to see it.
He didn't want to know.
His life was settled the way it was, and he was quite comfortable.
Yeah, he was happy and comfortable, and he tried to disparage Marley. So you might just be, a piece of cheese or something I ate that's, you might just a big bit of my imagination.
Yeah. Indigestion.
Indigestion is bothering me and so forth. Leave me alone. Then even when he finds out and he believes, he tells the ghost, can't you just leave me alone? I just want to stay the way I am. I don't want to change. So it's true. And the ghosts reveal what is hidden to mortal eyes. They see more. They serve as supernatural messengers who reveal crimes that would otherwise have remained hidden. Their intervention is necessary for reality to be seen and understood and for justice to be done. And I think what Dickens is telling us here, and what we should understand as Catholics, is that it is through our spiritual lives and through, the orthodoxy, I'm going to say, the tradition of the church that we can, that reflects on and shows us as a mirror, perhaps, for what's really going on in the real world, material world around us. And without that mirror of the Bible, Christian story and so forth, we don't see reality as it really is. If we're just plain materialists, we are going to be trapped within that material world without being able really to step outside of it and take
blinded.
A look at it. You're blinded.
Blinded.
Right. You can't step outside of ourselves or outside of that world and look at it from above or a different perspective. And when you lose that perspective, you lose a whole understanding of reality. So this idea that religion or that thought or philosophy above and different from the material world is somehow superfluous and unnecessary. It's more necessary than the material around us because it explains what's going on. And without that, we're lost, and just as Scrooge was lost. At any rate, Dickens is indicating the role and purpose of the ghost that he will introduce to Scrooge and to us. They will show us not only Scrooge, but ourselves, in a manner that has the power to surprise us out of our own worldliness and to alert us to the spiritual realities that we are prone to forget. And so, they have a purpose. Marley's ghost, like the ghosts of Hamlet's father, is apparently a soul in purgatory and not one of the damned. So, because, they're coming back to the world and talking, in other words, in Hamlet, the ghost of his father is coming back and relaying a message to him. People from hell don't come back and do that. And at any rate, by the way, I'm going to digress here just a second. I was listening to Call to Communion the other day, and somebody came in and said, they couldn't understand the story in the Bible about, it was actually about probably purgatory more than hell, but about the person in hell that is separated, you know, in other words, from all the others in heaven, I guess. There's that huge chasm between the two.
Between heaven and hell.
Between heaven and hell that you mm-hmm. can't cross. Mm-hmm. But that person, you know, wants to cross, but he can't cross. And then he wants to, he realizes this is the same thing is going to happen to his brothers if they don't change.
Right.
I wonder if Dickens was moved to write the story a little bit by that story itself right there.
Perhaps.
But the point is, somebody called in and said, how can somebody in hell be concerned about, you know, in other words, this person wants to do good. How is somebody in hell supposed to be evil? How can they want to do good? How can they be concerned about their brothers and so forth and want goodness and so forth for their brothers? Well, the fact is that you really can't use the Bible as some kind of a catechism to explain. That's not what the story in the Bible is about. You know, it's not about that. And when you try to take the Bible literally and make everything in it be some kind of a explanation of Christianity and some kind of explanation of how we should believe everything, you are going to find, you know, run into trouble and all kinds of distortions. The Bible really can't be read that way. It's not an instruction book on how to be a Christian. You know, there is enough in it to be a Christian, but it's not laid out like some kind of an instruction book to be a Christian, and you can take everything that everything has to be laid out according to some kind of theology that it, you know, fits perfectly. It's not a theological book. It's not a book to instruct you on how to understand, you know, everything. It wasn't designed for that. And it didn't drop down out of heaven as some kind of instruction book. And I think maybe a lot of people, including Catholics, get stuck in that mode because, you know, we live in a Protestant world, the Western civilization anymore, and there's this understanding of the Bible as some kind of an instruction book for Christianity and a catechism or, you know, an explanation of theology and liturgy and so forth, and it just isn't so. And so if you try to make every story fit, like somehow or another, you know, that this guy in hell couldn't be doing this, that's not the intention. It's not the intention of showing the theology of hell.
No, it's not. It's just that he wants to give warning to his brother.
Yeah.
That if you continue as you are, this is where you're going to end up, and you're going to be miserable.
And this is what Marley's ghost is doing. So,
right.
So when you
when you get to the topic of the Bible, you know, there is that if you take the word Bible, and the B stands for before basic instructions before leaving Earth, you know, B-I-B-L-E, that these are basic things in the Bible. You're talking about people, you know, reading a liturgy. Literally. It's true.
Yeah, you can't.
It's a basic thing.
Yeah, it's just general principles. It's not some kind of an absolute, you know, every little thing in the Bible has to be somehow or another in accordance with some kind of rational theology of everything. It just doesn't work that way. Anyhow, Marley's ghost, like the ghost of Hamlet's father, is apparently a soul in purgatory. It says not one of the damned. And this is evident from its penitential and avowedly Christian spirit and its desire to save Scrooge from following in its folly-laden footsteps. When Scrooge seeks to console him with a reminder that he has always been a good man of business, Marley's ghost wrings his hands in conscience-driven agitation. Business, he cries. Mankind was my business. The common welfare was my business. Charity, mercy, forbearance, and benevolence were all my business. The dealings of my trade were but a drop of water in the comprehensive ocean of my business. In other words, Scrooge has made his business, and of course Marley before he died too, everything. And Marley has come to understand that it's too late, though, for Marley, that his business was just one thing among many things in this world, and it was not to rule everything. And Scrooge is going to have to learn that lesson, and of course he does. If Marley's ghost is the spirit of a mortal man suffering penitentially and purgatorily for its sins, the ghosts of Christmas past, present, and yet to come are best described as angels. They are divine messengers. Angelos in Greek means messenger. More specifically, They might be seen as Scrooge's own guardian angels, as can be seen from the first ghost's description of himself as not being the ghost of long past, but of Scrooge's own past. The final aspects of A Christmas Carol that warrants mention, especially in light of its poignant pertinence to our own mysterious or meretricious times, is its celebration of life in general and the lives of large families in particular. The burgeoning family of Bob Cratchit, in spite of its poverty, or dare we say because of it, is the very hearth and home from which the warmth of life and love glows through the pages of Dickens's story. At the very heart of that hearth and home is the blessed life of the established of the disabled child, Tiny Tim, which shines forth in Tiny Tim's love for others and in the love that his family has for him. His very presence is the light of charity that serves catalytically to bring Scrooge to his senses. After his conversion, Scrooge no longer sees the poor and disabled as being surplus to the needs of the population who should be allowed to die, as in our own day they are routinely killed or culled in the womb, but as a blessing to be cherished and praised. And I think we have in our own time this idea that we're so much better than the people back at the time of Charles Dickens, that were, you know, this the Industrial Revolution and the supposedly materialism of the, you know, the dirty, the, you know, factories and so forth of the day. Somehow we've risen above all that. But take a look at our own record. How many people have we in the West killed through the process of abortion? Mm-hmm. Probably a lot more than ever starved to death or died of, you know, causes because of the cruelty of the Industrial Revolution. So I don't think we should be
talking
so.
Talking about thousands a day.
Right. Anyhow, it goes on. It says, for this love of life, even of the life of the disabled, especially of the life of the disabled, is at the heart of everyone who knows the true spirit of Christmas, as exemplified in the helplessness of the babe of Bethlehem. And so, as Tiny Tim observed, God blesses everyone. And that's, of course, how the story ends. And I think it's a great story, and it's a story of redemption. And it's a story of Scrooge, you know, coming back from his errant path. And it also incorporates this idea of, you find in the Bible, of the person, I can't remember the story, the person's name, separated from you know, the rest, wanting to somehow warn his brothers. And, of course, in his case, learning that he can't do it, that he doesn't have the power to do it, and that his brothers already have the information that they need to live as they should, and they won't listen anyway. In the case of Scrooge, I think Dickens takes this same theme and sort of rearranges it so that Scrooge is able to learn from the warnings he's been given. And because they're so dramatic.
Oh, they are. Yeah. He gets drugged out of bed and out into the cold and drugged to the cemetery and drugged to his past and his future.
And he was
struggling and kicking all the way.
Exactly. Because he's brought back to those things that were very, very painful, you know, that
his life,
his life as a miser has sort of buried. You know, and sort of substituted and so forth, and he's brought back to that, and he's in such a dramatic way. And I love the best, I think, of all the movies that were made of A Christmas Carol is the one with, I think it was made in 1953, I think that was about the year, with Alastair Sims.
Yes.
Alastair Sims, the English actor Alastair Sims. I think that is the classic Scrooge in that one.
Oh, I think so, too. They really get the feeling of it more so than some of the others. The one, the newest one, what's his name was in it?
You mean the one it's Scrooged, C-R-O-O-G, Scrooged.
Yes,
you know,
right.
Yeah, with Bill Murray.
Modern Days with Bill Murray.
With Bill Murray,
right.
Yeah, that's pretty good, too. It's funny.
It is
it's
pretty good, but it's it doesn't leave you with the same odd wonder.
No. I think the classic one is the Alistair Sims one. And I love that one part in there where poor Marley, I mean, not Marley, but I mean, you know, Cratchit, poor Bob Cratchit is giving one day a year, he's getting his day off, you know. And, of course, Scrooge makes him work all the harder, usually the next day. And Scrooge lectures him and all that on taking a day off for Christmas. And then Scrooge tells him, you know, I mean, Cratchit tells him, it's very kind of you, sir. You know, and of course, it's not very kind at all. And then Scrooge says, you don't have to tell me that. I already know it.
Right.
It really puts the touch on it, doesn't it?
Yes, it does.
And it's when somebody is redeemed like that, it's such a dramatic redemption. So.
Well.
It comes back like that. It's a great story. I think it's my favorite also. My second favorite, I guess, the Dickens first. I've read others, and I had to do some, you know, as an English major. But my other favorite is still all the way from the time, you know, that I was a freshman in high school, Great Expectations. I love that. And I love Dickens' characters. And if kids nowadays don't have the chance to read these things and actually read them, not see this stuff online, they're missing a lot.
Oh, they are. They are.
At any rate, we're going to have to stop there, and we wish everybody out there a great Advent season and a Merry Christmas. Next week, we will be talking about the Latin Mass, and we'll have a guest on, Floyd Anderson, who will be here to talk about it with us, who is in the process with the group of trying to establish a Latin Mass here in the Peoria Diocese. So we're going to be talking about that. It should be a very interesting show. And until then, St. Michael,
the Archangel, defend us in battle.
Be our protection against the wickedness and snares of the devil. May God rebuke him, we humbly pray. And do thou, Prince of the heavenly hosts, by the power of God, thrust into hell Satan and all evil spirits who wander through the world for the ruin of souls. Amen.
You've been listening to Being Catholic with Bob Johnston on Catholic Spirit Radio 89.5. If you'd like to contact Bob, email bob@catholicspiritradio.com. Again, that's bob@catholicspiritradio.com. Catholic Spirit Radio relies on your support to bring programming like this and EWTN to Central Illinois 24 hours a day. Please help keep Catholic Spirit Radio on the air with your generous support. Donate online at catholicspiritradio.com. Or send a donation to Catholic Spirit Radio, 108 Boykins Place, Normal, Illinois, 61761. That's Catholic Spirit Radio, 108 Boykins Place, Normal, Illinois, 61761. Catholic Spirit Radio is a 501c3, and all donations are tax deductible. Thank you for your support of Catholic Spirit Radio 89.5.